Blog Talk Radio.
Ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie before us, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does this amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend? Merry Christmas.
Thank you. Thank you. And Merry Christmas to you and your family, too. Did you have a good one?
We had a very nice Christmas. And a little follow-up to last week's show. It turns out the big guy did bring some Star Wars-themed presents to our home. So,
well, my son got a... You had to say, you know what, I'm not sure 100% because, you know, the big guy has his own ideas about things. But sure enough,
yeah.
He showed up with a couple Star Wars-themed things. Good.
Actually, he and I are usually pretty simpatico. I mean, this is one of the things I've been talking to my kids about. I try not to be too obvious about it, but I say things like, you know, he and I kind of look alike when you think about it. And I'm kind of fat, and he's fat, and I talk like him. And we're a lot alike when you think about it. But
yeah, we're jolly. We
jolly,
think you guys
exactly.
Great.
We have a lot in common.
Yeah, that's right.
So, we got a lightsaber, and my daughter got a Star Wars book, and there were a couple other, I think, Star Wars-themed things in there as well. A lot of Minions. Minions were very big this year, and some Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Palace Pets, probably something you're not
in an all-boy house. In an all-boy house, we don't see a lot of that. But
we did see the Palace Pets.
Yeah, we did see the Star Wars, that was real big this year. Even my oldest kids were playing Star Wars Battlefront, which is one of the latest first person shooter kind of things for the Star Wars universe, and they were having a big time with that. So I mean, from the littlest in our household to me, we all were kind of doing the Star Wars thing this Christmas, so that was fun.
Excellent. Oh, and another update. On Christmas Day, I went and saw Star Wars, The Force Awakens, with my daughter and my son-in-law.
Right.
So I've seen the movie now, enjoyed it very much, liked it very much.
Awesome. At some point, maybe we give it another month or so, we ought to come back and do like a spoiler-laden, discussion about it. But let's give our audience a little more time. We don't want to... we don't want to talk about such things until everybody's had a good chance to go see it.
Sure. Plus, we'll let it settle, let it percolate a little bit. I've got a lot of questions, I've got a lot of observations, a lot of comments. I am going to make one observation right now, and I mean this sincerely. I mean this in a helpful way. If J.J. Abrams happens to be listening, okay, never mind Neil deGrasse Tyson and all his tweets about the scientific problems with the movies. Buddy, you need to understand how space works, okay? I've seen three space movies of yours now, and you don't understand space, so give me a call, and I will personally
get
explain
hooked up with
space
that guy
to you.
Mars. the guy from the
exactly.
Martians, he kind of understands it. But I'm going to tell you, Star Wars is not about scientific accuracy, of course.
But I believe there's a line. I believe there's a line. There is a there's a level of credibility, and we'll get into it when we talk about the show. Interestingly, I feel got crossed in the first Star Trek movie, but I let it go, And it's like something so similar happens in this movie. I'm like, oh, come on. But we'll talk about it when we talk about it. Perhaps you have some idea what I'm talking about. Maybe not. Things like that really bug me. Anyhow, it'll be fun to get into all that. But I loved it. I had a great time. Liked the new characters, as you said. It's fun to have it back. It's fun to have it back.
Right. Did the new characters appeal to you as strongly? And I came away from it going, loved seeing the old characters. Man, those new characters are great. I can't wait to see more of them. And so that's their success when they prime the pump for more, for more great Star Wars entertainment. So
absolutely.
With no spoilers said, that's just go see it. You'll have a good time.
Absolutely. But we've got work to do tonight. We can't be geeking out on Star Wars this evening because we've got to give the year in review, and we've bitten off quite a bit here, Stephen, because we have to do 3 years in review, and in the process, we're going to do a century in review, I guess. Because what I thought we'd do this week is, everybody's doing their year in review show. If you want to hear
for 2015.
Reflections on 2015. There's lots of other podcasts you can tune into, but we thought, well, we're about the future, so we'll do a year in review for 2016. And then I said, but wait, there's more. Why don't we stretch it out 50 years and see if we can do a year in review for 2066? We were talking before the show. I really should have made that 2065, but I just liked all those sixes. Once I had one number ending in six, it just looked better to have the rest of them ending in six. So 2066, and then 100 years, 2116. So 1 year, 100 years, or 101 years, and, 51 years and 100 years. So 101.
Well,
anyway,
and here's what I would suggest, is that we're let's get in our time machine and speak of it in the past tense and have fun with this. So, Bill, let's get in the time machine and take off to the end of next year.
December 27th, 2016. We're looking back over the year that has just passed, and let me tell you one of the big news items from the year, Stephen. This is one of the things that we could have seen coming, but it seems like we'd seen kind of false horizons for this one before. But that new social network that came along just completely from under the radar, and suddenly it's the biggest threat ever to Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. It showed up reasonably early in the year, and
what do you think, Bill? You think those older established social networks rest on their laurels a little too much, and along comes this upstart and just really begins to rock them a little bit? What do you think accounted for this in 2016?
Victims of their own success. I mean, even a year ago, even in December of 2015, I could have said, look at what's happening to Twitter, the slowdown that even then was occurring on Twitter, and the growth slowdown that even then was occurring on Facebook. And even if you look at Instagram following a very similar curve, they become the established thing, and that creates the opportunity for this new player to come along and do what it did so well, which was suddenly become new and shiny. You can't be established with hundreds of millions of users and the behemoth and the new and shiny thing at the same time. Bill Gates will explain that to you too, if you ever need. The only company that's ever successfully managed to remain new and shiny is Apple, right? And they do it a little bit differently.
They have to periodically reinvent themselves too. So You're right. Once you've seen the success where you've conquered the world, you don't want to change anything, do you? Every little tweak is you got people that are religiously devoted to some little feature, and any little tweak upsets people both within the organization and your customer base. So you got to, I really feel for these guys and what they're facing with this upstart.
Well, and the other thing is, once you become that big, it becomes a matter of steering the Titanic. One of the things that Google has done so well is that they have managed to stay very responsive by kind of keeping everything in small chunks. But Google has never really launched a successful social network. And here in 2016, we've seen Google Plus, continue its, I would say, pretty much finish its death spiral, and creating all the more
space. In fact, Phil, I think it actually, they pulled the plug in the middle of the year, didn't they? At some point in 2016, I forget exactly.
Yeah, it was somewhere in there. They said, okay, we give.
Yeah.
it was a sad day for, you know, the 11 Google employees who were still on there.
The last one out had to click the like.
Now what do we do? Yeah, exactly. So that, you know, that was a fairly big one. And I would say of all the things we're going to talk about, probably in some ways kind of the most predictable within, say, a five-year window of 2015. If we're looking back at 2015, you say, is something like this going to happen, you know, for sure? In what period of time would it happen for sure? Would it happen for sure in 2016? I would have said, well, maybe not. It could, but for sure it'll happen in the next 5-10 years. You know, somebody big is going to come along and pose a big threat like this. And sure enough, these guys did. So we'll see how it pans out. Do the big boys do they swing back, or does this new upstart do they become the behemoth who finally gets replaced? Stay tuned. We'll tell you in 2017, I guess, when we revisit
that. Yeah.
What else happened in 2016?
Okay, in 2016, it was the year that virtual reality became real for the public. Now, I mean, it's been a sort of an academic project and project of tinkerers for years and years, Phil. But it became real in entertainment. Traditional video gaming is feeling the effects of this. It's going to become a challenge to regular video games. So several products were released. Sony Morpheus was released. Oculus Rift was released in 2016. And the HTC Vive, they all came to market.
That all happened this year in 2016. It's amazing.
All in 2016. And particularly like with Sony Morpheus, it just plugged right into the PlayStation 4, and you know there's a huge base for that. And so it should come as no huge surprise that a lot of people tried it, and unlike the 3D televisions that were sort of a fad, that kind of came and went, this appears to be staying with us. This the ability to enter your own world and to truly immerse yourself in a video game is something that gamers, are adopting in droves. But here's the real surprise. Productivity applications are in development. And we've seen the first beta versions of VR CAD that allows people to do computer-aided design within a 3D a virtual reality room. And these are a little rough right now, but the promise is huge, Bill. There's just nothing like being able to, you know, if you're designing a house, to just literally put your hands on the wall and push, you know, to the wall to where you want it to be, change colors on the fly, you know, just for designing the house, for decorating house, you know, there's just nothing like it. And you can do that with all products. I mean, you do it with an engine. It is even a big deal with surgeons. They're looking at, you know, they can examine what needs to be done on a 3D model of the person they're about to do surgery on, and see how best to perform the surgery. So these things are not just for entertainment. It's going to be a huge deal going forward. And 2016, people will look back and say, yeah, 2016 was the year it became real for people. And it really
wasn't
before.
Applications are emerging rapidly. That's what's really interesting to see here at this point now is as these products have been released, as they're becoming viable, people are figuring out new and more interesting things to do with them, things that we never would have thought of. You might remember more than a year ago on the show I talked about a colleague of mine who was doing data analysis, data discovery applications on VR, looking at virtual reality for that, and that, you know, that's just a this very abstract world.
Our human brains are the best pattern recognition computers still, even here at the end of 2016 in the world. And to be able to step into the data three-dimensionally, you know, to walk through it, you can just spot these patterns. You know, we have brains that were developed for the Stone Age, and, you know, we lived in 3D worlds and did 3D things. And that being able to walk through the data like that, you can spot trends and do analysis. It just really was, you know, it would take so much additional time, and you simply wouldn't spot all the things that you can spot this way. So,
right, we were designed to operate in a fully immersive, three-dimensional, visual, tactile, aural, you know, nasal, whatever, olfactory environment. You know, the more of those senses you can hit, the more real you can make that environment, the more new kinds of experiences you can create and apply it in ways that we're still just discovering. I think we're in the very early days of this, and we're going to see some really amazing things happening with this.
Yep. Well, that's awesome. Well, what's another development of 2016 you saw, Phil?
Well, you know, obviously we're still reeling here in the U.S. from what has to be the most contentious and divisive presidential election since the Civil War.
Yeah.
I think that we're cautiously optimistic that now that it's firmly established that we. Go ahead.
Yeah. When this person is sworn in, Phil, we're all optimistic and hopeful that this person will be a good president. But, you know, man, it got down and dirty, didn't it?
Well, it did. I have to say that I wasn't I haven't been thrilled with the choices ever. Okay. You know, I can't remember a year when I said, boy, I am so excited to have these two to choose between. You know, let me just count my blessings. But this year was especially bad, and I think we've reached a turning point, really, in American political discourse, where people are looking at everything. They're looking at social media. They're looking at the media. They're looking at our party system. They're looking at the way we view each other differently now. Because if there's one big lesson learned from the last year and a half, however long this mess has been going on, thank goodness it's finally over. It's it's not an optimal process for choosing leaders. You know, it maybe it can be again, but we've tweaked with it somewhere along the way, and what we're doing with it is just not it's just not delivering the goods. You know, I think when we look at you know, how you hire staff and the steps you go through to make sure that you have the best person doing the job, or how you buy a car, right? And the steps you go through to make sure that you're making the right choice, just as consumers of government, I think this is the year we realized that we are not delivering ourselves a good product, and we're not doing ourselves any favors by kind of playing out this highly contentious, highly hostile drama. This almost kind of kabuki theater that we've been going through for the past year, really, but especially it got bad there in the fall. And I think the more
I examine systems like parliamentary democracies, Phil, the more I find the like, you know, where it's governments are in places like Israel and even the UK and places like that, you know, they have to have a consensus of a number of different groups. The prime minister may come from one party, but in order to have a government, to assemble a government, he has to reach across to various other groups and kind of build a consensus. And there's something to be said for that. You know, it keeps you from going too far left or right or whatever direction, you know, and keeps things a little bit, there's a few more checks on the power of of those prime ministers and places like that. So,
well, I think, yeah, the problem is our system as it exists was just too prone to go full internet, right? And if you look back over the past year, essentially our whole political process has turned into a big YouTube comment flame war, right? I mean, that's
well, you never want to go full internet. You never want to go full internet.
You don't. You don't want to go full YouTube comment thread, that's for sure. That's, you know, we've got to start working. We got to stop trolling each other and start working together. You know, we don't have to agree on everything, but we have to agree that we're all in this together. And I hopefully that's the big lesson learned from this most recent election. And God bless the new president. We'll have better things to report.
This president
4 years
from now. Has something, you know, as a real, you know, chore, you know, to bring people together. And so our best to this new president. Okay, my next one. For the year 2016, 3D printing has become a big deal, Phil. I mean, you know, it's been coming along kind of slowly, 2014, 2015. I think it was 2014, Phil, that I got a 3D printed cap for one of my teeth. Okay. And I think that's pretty much, you know, anybody that goes in and gets caps anymore, that's what they do. And in a larger sense, I mean, any prosthetic, if you need a prosthetic arm or whatever, you know, the old ways of doing those things, people don't get those anymore. They get them 3D printed because every person's body is different. And 3D printing even organs for organ transplants and things like that, they're beginning to do this. And 2016 saw the first, a kidney transplant, so 3D printed kidneys and things like that. And we're hopeful that the hearts come along soon, you know, be able to do that. It's remarkable how much success they've had with that. Of course, you know, and then there's the market for hard to find replacement parts, for machinery.
Right.
You know, if you couldn't be found in a junkyard, then you'd have to, get out and make it, which would be potentially, time consuming. These things now can be 3D printed, and there's specialty shops popping up all over, Phil, you may have noticed, I provide the public with limited run things like that, maybe you just need one or two of. It's expensive, when you buy something that's just one of a kind, but at least it's available. It just, those sort of things used to not be.
If you'll recall, way back in 2013, we had a guy on the show. He was the head of a technology group at one of the schools here in Douglas County, Colorado, and it was the first school in Colorado to have a 3D printer. Last year, in 2015, my wife and I were shopping around for kindergarten for our twins, and the school we went to, we were taking a look at the place, and I said, I want to see the technology lab, and they showed us the technology lab. And just a random school had a 3D printer, And now my kids are going to that school. My second grade daughter now has access to a 3D printer. You know, something that was a specialized, one of a kind thing just a few years ago is now becoming commonplace to almost everybody's experience. It's taken off in the way laser printers did back in the mid '80s. Something that you heard about, and suddenly it's right in your face, and everyone's got them, everyone's using them. If you don't have one, you feel like you're missing out. Or if you don't have one, you're at least accessing the products of them one way or another. It seems like it's touching all of them now. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and most people don't, and maybe a lot of people never will, but whether you have one or not in your home, you have access to the products that come off of these things, that's kind of neat, and so that's become a big deal. But there must have been a dozen new printers in 2016 that came out, Phil, that people could buy and even in places like Walmart, you may have noticed in the last 3 or 4 months they had 2 or 3 different options. And so that's kind of neat to be seeing them everywhere. And you know, the maker culture has really embraced these things. Tinkerers love them. You know, you'd think, well, you know, maybe doesn't that take the tinkering out of tinkering? Not really. You print the parts and you still get to tinker with them. So it's just another tool in the tool shed for a lot of these guys, and a particularly fun one. And so it's become a big deal. This is 3D printing. It hasn't quite awakened as fast as the virtual reality thing in 2016, but it's a little slower burning.
Right.
But it's becoming more important.
It's going to catch on. I mean, it's going to catch up. It's going to be so huge. If I was going to pick one thing that happened in 2016, that's momentum is growing. Even, you know, the momentum is probably growing even more rapidly than VR. Actually, it'll be interesting to track both of those because they're both taking off like hotcakes. This time next year to see which one has surged ahead, or whether VR is still outpacing 3D printing. But these are two technologies to watch, and both of them are accelerating very rapidly now. Absolutely. Well, our next topic, we're not going to spend too much time on this one, Stephen, because you know we already did two shows on this, and I feel like we're just going to beat a dead horse here. But we can hardly let a year in the year in review for 2016 go by without mentioning the fact that astronomers have discovered compelling, not entirely conclusive, but the best evidence so far for extraterrestrial life. And I think if you look back over the years, when there have been, you know, shards of meteorite that, you know, came from Mars that had something that looked like a fossil on it, or if you recall last year, there was this interest in large structures that Kepler had found, that a large mass in space that could, you know, we were saying potentially could be some large artificially built structure. Well, this latest evidence comes from a completely unexpected source, and we look at it and we say, wow, you know, I would not have thought that evidence for life out in the universe would even come to us along these lines, and yet here it is. And I think we have to contemplate this possibility much more seriously than we have before. We still don't know for sure, but it's really looking like we found something here. And it'll be interesting to see what happens in coming years.
Well, you know, I was reading, just recently, Phil, I guess it was like a couple of weeks ago, December of, 2016, a couple of weeks ago, that Vegas odd makers are putting like 60-40 in favor of this panning out, in favor of this being extraterrestrial life. You know, my thought is, you know, this may be a bet that's a long time in paying off, but it's still it's interesting that they're laying odds actually in favor of it. So, that'll be fun to watch.
The confirmation will be a long time coming, that's for sure. I mean, as we talked about in the other shows, one of the questions is, well, if they're there, do we even try to reach out to them? Do we even try to communicate them? What do we do with this information now that we have it? It's a huge existential question. And yes, even how we would confirm it isn't entirely clear. But you know what? I might take that bet. You know, those are pretty good odds. I think we're onto something. And anyway, it was an unexpected big breakthrough in 2016.
Yeah. As Carl Sagan would say, it would be a lot of wasted space, wouldn't it?
There you go.
Something more. So, all right.
If they're not there.
Another thing for 2016. Well, driverless cars. 2016 Cadillac, the Cadillac CT6. Lane keeping technology, active cruise control. It's virtually able to drive itself completely on its own in highway environments, and that hit the market this year, and big deal. And there's less advanced active cruise vehicles are with some forms of lane holding are beginning to be the rule rather than the exception in a lot of high end cars, Phil. And so that's a big deal. We're not quite to the fully self driving, take me to grandma's house while I take a nap kind of cars, but we're seeing some actual things hit the market, and that's kind of cool.
So, let me tell you, if okay, we're not ready to take a nap and go to grandma's, but if you accidentally nod off in this one, as people have in Cadillacs many times over the years, you're a lot better off, right, than you would have been.
Yeah. If you nodded off in a Cadillac back in 2010, you're in big trouble. In this one,
right.
you might bump your head on the steering wheel, but it's going to keep you in your lane. And you'll wake up with a start and realize, well, hey, maybe I need a cup of coffee. So I can monitor this car a little better. But that's so much better. That's so much of a better outcome. So we're excited to say also that, hey, it has not been an increase in accidents as a result of this. As far as a decrease in accidents, that's still up in the air. But there has not been any noticeable increase due to these vehicles being on the highway.
One of the things people were making a lot of noise about a year ago, you'll recall, was that the Google self-driving cars were unable to merge with traffic effectively on the highway because they couldn't speed. And so they would come to a stop, and then they would get rear-ended by other cars on the ramp who, you know, just couldn't believe a car would stop rather than, you know, speed up to 10 to 20 miles an hour over the speed limit in order to merge correctly with traffic. Looks like that problem got solved. And we can expect that other such problems will materialize as these vehicles become more commonplace. But I think you're absolutely right. There's certainly no increase in accidents. There might be new different kinds of accidents that we'll see a few of here and there. But generally speaking, I think the roads are getting safer and safer thanks to the introduction of these vehicles.
I agree. Well, Phil, unless you have another one, I'm going to go to my last one.
Okay.
Here's the deal. You know, it seemed like over the years, Phil, that we would, you know, when we first started doing this way back in 2005, we would occasionally hit a new article about, you know, cancer, something exciting about cancer. And then it got to, you know, you'll recall it seemed like the last half of maybe 2015. It was like, you know, every single week there'd be, here's the way we're going to cure cancer this week.
Right.
Well, 2016 seems to be the year where some of this is beginning to come to fruition. Formerly radical treatments actually are increasing survival rates now. And the general public, not just, you know, crazy guys like us that are, you know, are watching these trends closely, but, I mean, the general public is starting to believe that cancer is something that will be more or less cured within a decade. And, of course, scientists, as a whole, scientists will not speculate on the time frame, but scientists being human are, you know, finding it hard to conceal their excitement. And you'll recall there was one researcher, Phil, that said, well, this Dracula is facing 10 Van Helsings, and the big question is which one gets to hammer the stake in.
Right.
And so
right.
we're all extremely excited about the advancements made in 2016. And, we got this enemy surrounded, and we're closing in, and that's exciting.
Yes, absolutely. This has been a very big year in that regard. And with that, we'll have to say farewell to the wonderful year 2016. And we're going to jump ahead in time, 50 years, to the year 2066. And I see, Stephen, you got more of these than I do, so I'm going to let you do one first, and then we'll get to one of mine.
Okay, so.
Although that does give you three in a row. I don't know.
Three in a row? Well, you know.
Unprecedented.
You
jeez. Right, go ahead.
Okay.
No, right,
so here's the year 2066, okay?
Yeah,
and,
what happened?
So,
I can't remember.
Okay. Well, here's the deal. With low employment being a rule on Earth, and I think you may be talking about this a little bit too, but and with virtual reality indistinguishable from base reality, that's what we call it these days, base reality, off-world employment has become both satisfying and tolerable.
Mm.
So, you know, Phil, you know that I'm a relatively early pioneer to Mars, and I spend my days overseeing a mostly robotic factory at Ceria Planum. And I'm one of about 100,000 people now living and working on Mars. But in the evenings, you know, you think, well, that's, you know, Mars, that's is exciting. You're employed, you know. Most people on Earth are not. But
right.
You know, you got a job. And but you know, at the end of my day, you know, I by way of the magic of virtual reality, I'm on the Kauai's North Shore. That's where I usually spend my days. I've got a little house there, and And it's, you know, as you know, Phil, VR has for over a decade been indistinguishable from base reality. So I'm quite happy in my home with my family there on the north shore of Kauai, watching the waves come in. So, yeah, and we expect, the Martian population to double within the next 5 years. Earth-based space elevators have significantly cut the cost of coming here. Getting into orbit was the big expense. Well, that expense is now a fraction of what it once was, and it's also safer. So people are coming, it'd be exciting to have some more neighbors. So that's a big deal.
It's a very big deal. You've actually touched on a couple of my topics, but we'll come back around to both of those. The bottom line is it's become an option. I mean, it's a realistic option. 100,000 people is still, a tiny sliver of the population of Earth, but that's a substantial number of people we've got living and working on Mars. And when you count the people,
I'm talking mostly original substrate, of course. If you count AIs, I mean, we got the population of New York City here on Mars now.
As we've discussed many times on the show, the problem with counting AI population is it splits off and it recombines.
They combine and all of a sudden you got half the AIs that you did before, or they split up. You know, it's hard to keep.
And you've got 10 times as many, for a day, it's tricky to count them. But I was just going to say, between 100,000 on Mars, the numbers that are now starting to live on the moon, the people that we have venturing out into the asteroid belt, and just the Earth orbit satellites that are being contemplated, and the two that are now up, this has become truly the new frontier, hasn't it? I mean, we've really seen that open up over the past few years, and I think hitting that 100,000 mark on Mars was absolutely a huge milestone. Big move this year for that. Good stuff.
Yeah.
All right, we got to keep going because we got a bunch of these to cover. Another big number we hit this year. I don't know if you realize this, Stephen, but the 10 millionth member of Generation X to celebrate his or her 100th birthday did so in the year 2066. Isn't that amazing?
And you're over 100 now, Phil, right?
I'm one of the more than 10 million boomers who are who've made it past the 100 mark. Unfortunately, there's a kind of a transition between those two generations that really tells the tale of when life extension actually kicked in. Being kind of a younger boomer, a late boomer, as I like to say, I got in on that curve. It actually took my generation until the year 2064 to reach the 10 million mark on how many of us made it to 100, and Gen X did it in 2 years. So I think that shows you the difference in survival rates between the new generations. But 20, 30 years from now, we'll be seeing, many, many more Gen Xers and millennials who will vastly outnumber the number of centenarians. But, even so, today we've got more than 25 million people aged 100 or older in the U.S. Can you believe those numbers? It's happened very rapidly over the past few years, and it's gonna continue growing almost exponentially.
Well, I'm still the kid on the show, then, Phil. I'm nearly 97. So, anyway,
Gen X got there without your help, Stephen. You didn't even have
<That's>
to.
Right. I did. I did not contribute to making that 100 mark. The other thing, here in 2066, non-automated driving is relegated to closed tracks. Most adults have never driven. Here on Mars, people drive a lot more often because, quite frankly, we have lots of space, lots of wide open spaces to drive.
Right.
But back on Earth still, I believe that, most people don't bother with it anymore, and because it's just so much safer to allow the cars to do it for us.
Yeah, I think You know, a few years ago, really, we finally started letting go of the idea of driving. It reminds me of something. Steve, we've been doing the show so long now. You know, what have we been doing the show? Like 60-some years we've been doing this. But it reminds me of conversations we had many, many years ago, decades ago, about how landline phones finally died out, right? That's kind of what's happening with people driving cars. It's so embedded, so ingrained that you have this thing that it takes a long time. And in fact, the demographic shift that I just described probably has something to do with it as well. But people have finally kind of gotten used to living in a world where, you know, the AI does it well. I can take a nap. I can get to grandma's house. That's not a problem. And you know, why should I bother? And I think that's
I think it's also maybe. You know, it's kind of in a way to horseback riding. People still ride horses here in 2066. There's none on Mars, but that's something I miss. But you know what? I think I'll go horseback riding on the beach in my VR later this evening. That sounds like fun. But anyway,
that's a great idea.
People drive, you know, for fun on these closed tracks, and of course in VR environments they can do whatever they want driving. But in base reality, they people just decide, you know what, it's just too dangerous. Let's let the cars do it, and we're better off for it. I mean, the main cause of death, violent death, used to be, back in the early 21st century, it was definitely due to trauma in these automobile accidents. Well, it just doesn't happen anymore. So
it's unimaginable that people would ever have tolerated that today.
Well, I guess people tolerate what they have to, Bill, and we don't have to, so we don't tolerate it. So
we don't put up with it. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, let me throw out a interestingly related one. You talked about the fact that people don't need to get out as much because they spend so much time in VR. Do you know? And I know the number is going to be substantially higher for Mars, but half of the U.S. population now spends at least 20% of their time in fully immersive VR. So half of us spend up to a fifth of our day, at least, in fully immersive VR. And as you were saying, Stephen, I mean, you've basically got a second home in VR, so you spend, 40, 50% of your time there. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the place where I actually lay my head at night on Mars is very Spartan. And it's not anything great, but you know, I just when I've put in a full day's work, which by the way is with augmented reality, you know,
sure,
I'm walking and talking and working with AIs that are in my field of vision with my augmented reality, but at the end of the day, you know, I just plug into this virtual reality and live there, and it's there's a lot to like about Mars, but you know, you could get sick of it and get tired of it and want to go home. And quite frankly, I'm needed here, so it's great to have VR. I suspect that I spend a lot more than 20% of my time in VR. So
yeah, and we do have a growing number of people on Earth. I don't think it's the one transition that people are making here that I don't think they're making out in space yet is spending all their time there, right? Because
if you bother to go to space, you've got things to do in base reality.
You've got things to do in space. That's right.
Yeah, but on Earth, maybe not so much. So
people making the lifestyle decision to just essentially more or less cut the cord with meat space and live in the virtual world. You know, there's been a lot of controversy about that over the years, but I think people are beginning to accept that it's not a bad option for a lot of people. The virtual world has an awful lot to offer people, and it's really ultimately for them to decide if that's where they want to be. You know, there were questions about sustainability and economic viability of the model. I think those are being worked out, and we can only expect to see those numbers rise, I think, in the years to come.
Right.
I think that's the big takeaway there. All right, we're dangerously running out of time here, Stephen. Give us more great news from 2066.
Okay, aging is the last disease. Pretty much, if it's something that can be caught, whether it be viral or bacterial, those problems are solved. We've taken care of that. But everyone continues to suffer from aging, and it's considered the chronic disease for which virtually all adults over 35 receive treatment. Some choose to receive kind of a constant upkeep type care. And then others spend about 6 months every decade in a rejuvenation fund.
Yep.
If you were to happen to show up, Phil, imagine this. Imagine you happen to show up at your doctor's office with an apparent age of, 60 years. Now, this is, 60 before any sort of age treatment. Okay.
Right.
If you were to show, what do you think your doctor would do if you just showed up looking 60?
I think he'd be really concerned.
About
what's going on with me. I think he'd probably want to run a psychological profile and check to make sure that I'm feeling okay. You know.
Right.
That is considered so abnormal. Looking back. It might sound horribly bigoted to earlier versions of ourselves doing this show to think that that people would have such a strong adverse reaction to aging. And in fact, I keep my apparent age around the mid-40s. I always felt like that was kind of my prime looking years, and I like to feel kind of grown up. But to let it slip into an apparent aging kind of thing is just viewed, I think, as kind of abnormal, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and it's not the years that you've lived on the planet that are the problem for the doctor. It's the fact that you're letting yourself deteriorate, and
right.
they look at that as a form of slow motion suicide. In fact, the guideline, it's not the law, but the guideline for doctors to follow, the general practice now, is if you present looking 60, and then they run tests, and you are 60 biologically speaking, then obviously you're not taking care of yourself, and they will as a matter of course prescribe psychological counseling. So. That's a little different from the way things used to be. That's the year in which we lived,
And no doubt an annoyance to people who, for religious reasons, don't do life extension and have to put up with that. But
that's right.
Small price to pay for that.
And there are a few that do. So the Amish continue to live a very simple life and to age more, the way that people used to age. And
We got a bunch of hippies up here in Boulder. They're never gonna adopt.
Yeah, they do their thing kind of on their own. So yeah, but by and large, people, once you've experienced a little of decrepitude, especially those of us that these treatments came along just in time for us. Phil, I keep my parent age at 35, believe it or not, and I allow my hair to be a little gray. Just to kind of communicate to the whippersnappers around me that I've been around a little while,
Right.
But I choose that particular age because, it's a physically demanding job, and so I need to be in good shape. So that's interesting. So
all right, Stephen, dash off two more for 66. We're going to have to move the time machine here quickly.
Okay, quickly. Let's see here. There are young people coming into adulthood today that don't recall a time without ever-present sentient AI. The argument about whether these intelligences are really conscious, that's been relegated to philosophy
seminars.
Yeah,
nobody cares. It's like,
nobody
yeah,
cares.
So what? Good enough for us.
Zero
yeah.
practical bearing. And in fact, it's thought to be in some instances bigoted. We know these people. These they're helpful. They have their lives and their concerns, and we have ours, and we're helpful to them, and they're helpful to us. And it's so once you've had AIs as your neighbor, or even as your ever present companion, you get to where the question of whether they experience subjective reality the same way we do, when we can't really even quantify what we're experiencing, people used to really be concerned about this field, but not so much anymore.
Absolutely, it's I think we called the show The World Transformed, and this is one of the the key transformations that we've been watching for decades, and it really has come into its own here in the past few years. And I think you're right, especially in this past year. Okay, Steve, you got one more? Got to zip
one
out.
One more. By way of cloning and genetic engineering, a dozen extinct large mammal species have small zoo populations now. We could have much more, but it's a matter of resources. And so we've got the mammoth, and we've got several other species like that, even saber-toothed tigers, I believe, at the Chicago Zoo. And so for now, these species remain classified as extinct. And I think that's for legal reasons. But they're really not, are they, Phil? When you can see these animals and experience being around them, then it's not, they're not extinct anymore. Not
we
like
went
they
looked
were
at mastodons extinct 2 weeks ago. The mastodons here in Denver, and let me tell you, they don't look extinct to me. They look like they're doing very well. Okay, the time machine is flying ahead into the year 2116. We are now looking back over the year 2116 that has passed. And, Stephen, in getting ready for this show, I did something. I went and listened to some of our old recordings from years past. I actually listened to our show from 50 years ago, from 2066. And I've got a couple updates on that show for you. One of the things that you had talked about on that program was how we had reached, you were living on Mars at the time, if you'll recall, how we had reached a 100,000 people living on Mars, what a milestone that was. And I was thinking about that as I was preparing the list because, as you know, here we are in 2116, off-Earth settlement is now seeing 1 million people moving into space every year. So 10 times that number every year moving into space with no end to that in sight. I think we hit a real milestone with that this year, and I think it's really become the norm to have the question of, well, do I want to live on Earth or do I want to live someplace else, be kind of a standard question that people ask as they're planning their life out, or how much of my life do I want to live on Earth, and how much of my life, as you've chosen for part of your life, do I want to be someplace else?
Well, I gave it a decade, and I'm back home on Earth, and and glad to be. It was quite an adventure, Phil. And I recommend that everybody spend some time off planet. It's eye opening. And besides, you'll get to be part of the pioneering spirit, pushing humanity out to new places. So, yeah. While I'm back, I might not stay back. The first generational starship has left the solar system for Alpha Centauri. It's interesting, Phil. I had no interest in taking that ride. Because it would have taken two or three generations to get there. Now, I would have made it. When we say generational, we're talking the old idea of, people dying out and another generation replacing it. Well, not so much. People,
unless they choose to, they don't die
of old age anymore. But,
using a pretty antiquated definition of generational at this point.
Yeah, they really are. But they're still calling them ships too.
That's true. Good point.
So they're on their way to Alpha Centauri. And here's the funny thing: there's concern among the passengers that warp drives are going to be invented back here in the solar system, and they're going to be beat to Alpha Centauri by some upstarts as they make their way very slowly to the nearest star, and they have some reason to be concerned about things like that because there's a warp researcher that's demonstrated faster than light communication by way of warp drive, so we're already sending communication faster than light, so it's it's just a matter of doing it with matter and with biological matter or with technology, and so we haven't quite gotten there with warp drive. It's just very, very expensive energy wise. The amount of energy it takes is almost unimaginable. But it seems like the more they research it, the more they find shortcuts to where they can do it with less and less energy. And so at some point maybe they'll produce something and will be out among the stars, and I hope so. I think I'd like to take that shorter ride to a nearer star.
And, well, I've been saying it for almost a century now, and I stand by it. I think that star travel really belongs to the AIs, and it belongs to us to the extent that we want to upload. That ultimately, you know, the energy savings are so substantial if we make it compact and send out smaller probes. But you know, we don't have true uploading yet. You know, we're getting closer and closer. But that's another technology that I think will have a big impact on how we decide to move to the stars. But yep, it's great to see that. To see that happening, it'll be interesting to see who gets to Alpha Centauri first, the slow ship or the fast ship or the one we haven't even imagined yet that somebody might come up with between now and then. You know, we did a show 100 years ago talking about the kind of turmoil that was going on in the U.S. With the presidential election that occurred. And 50 years ago, on our show, doing a recap of the year's events, you talked about how it was, you know, for the first time, people were accepting kind of ever-present AI as a part of our existence. Well, we've seen both of those stories forming over the last century kind of combine this year with the election of the first AI president of the United States. What's really interesting to me about this story is, Stephen, what a non-story it is. Guys like us who have been tracking these things forever, this is big news. But I guess that makes us seem almost like fossils, that we even find it something to note. But I can't help but say, you know, it's the first time it wasn't a human being born of another human being. I think it's a big step forward.
It's interesting that this president has chosen to maintain a physical form, sort of a nod to the old ways, I guess. This is an AI, and
we still need somebody to walk into the room so they can play Hail to the Chief, right? I mean, it's just, you know.
that's right, and you know, the physical White House is still a thing, you know. So, you know, we got that's I guess that's the reason for that. But
yeah, if you get summoned to the Oval Office, you want to meet somebody, right?
Not a
robot.
And this is a quite convincing physical form, and so you'd be hard pressed to even tell that it's, you know, that this is not a human in the Oval Office. I guess that may be part of the reason for non-story, but I think it's also just again, I mean, there's whole generations that have come up where AIs are just been such a part of the fabric of society that it's not that big of a thing, and so. So hopefully this will be a good president. The turmoil of the past 100 years, Phil. I'm hopeful that, you know, I'm hopeful for this president. And so
hopeful for the president. I got to say, the one great thing about this is a president we can each communicate with individually if we want to, and we've never really had
that
option before. This is
right.
If nothing else, this can
correspond with us all. So that's kind of neat. And the loneliest guy in that White House is the pollster.
There you go.
Not needed. But at any rate, okay. Well, that's. Let's see.
An update on the story we've been tracking for more than a century. As 3D printers have evolved into nanofabricators or universal assemblers, as we're almost calling them today, do you know there is now one of such machine for every three people on the planet? And I expect within the next 10 years there will be two or three for every person on the planet. That technology has taken off and has really become a ubiquitous part of how we operate, hasn't it?
It has. And, you know, you'll recall, Phil, that when we first started this program, there were vast differences in the wealth of nations, you know.
Right.
And not so much anymore. It's not that we have less. In fact, we have much more than we've ever had. The gap between the very wealthy and the very poor is diminished. It's diminished. I mean, you know, I suppose the very wealthy will always have the prettiest places to live because there's only a certain number of houses on the beach in the Hamptons, right? But you know, but by and large, material wealth is a lot more evenly distributed, in great part to the fact that you know, if you want it and you can think of it, you can, to a large extent, you can have it. And
between VR and universal assemblers, anybody can have just about anything they want.
Right.
Discussions of wealth inequality make us even more antiquated, Stephen, than talking about it's a big deal that an AI got elected
president. Well, you know, we have been around a while.
Yeah.
So.
We're just old guys.
150 years now? Wow. Gosh.
Yeah.
It's,
all right, so we've done it. We've covered a century of progress in one evening, Stephen. I guess that just leads us to ask what our music is.
Our music, way back here in 2015, is Detroit.
Yeah.
By Great White Buffalo.
Great White Buffalo with Detroit. Well, thank you, Stephen, for putting that together. Happy New Year to you and to everyone listening. We will be back with a brand new show next week. And until next time, live to see it.